Welcome to the Cancer Care Connect workshop. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. During the workshop, you will hear from our panel of expert speakers. We will allow time for questions and comments following the presentation. Instructions will be given at that time. If anyone requires assistance during the workshop, please press star then zero on your touchtone telephone. As a reminder, this workshop is being recorded. I would now like to introduce your moderator for today's workshop, Dr. Carolyn Messner, Director of Education and Training at Cancer Care. Please go ahead.
Well, thank you so much, Stephanie, and I, too, would like to welcome everyone to today's Cancer Connect Education Workshop, Advances in the Treatment of Lung Cancer. And today's program is part one of a two-part series of Living with Lung Cancer. Now, today's program is a collaborative effort between Cancer Care and many other cancer organizations. And I just want to particularly call out the lung cancer organizations that have really collaborated with us on this program today, lungcancer.org, Lung Cancer Alliance, Longevity Foundation. And they actually have all played a very important role in collaborating with us in making today's program possible, as well as all the other cancer organizations out there that really have worked so hard to kind of help spread the word about this program. And it's because of that collaboration and your interest in this program today, we have so many of you on the call today. Now, there are over 551 participants on the call today, and you come from all over the United States. And we also have international participants from Canada, the Netherlands, Romania, Switzerland, United Kingdom, and Venezuela. So it's truly an international group, and we are very delighted to have all of you on the call today. And it's also a credit to each of you that you're seeking information. That's a very important component of really keeping up to date with all the current information that's out there. Today's program is supported by AbbVie, Ariad Pharmaceuticals, Inc., Celgene Corporation, a grant from Genentech, a contribution from Lilly and Pfizer. And I really want to thank them for their support of the program today, and actually for this two-part series, but also for their corporate collaboration in making a series like this possible. Now, we have wonderful speakers on our program today, and I want to begin by introducing our first speaker. And our first speaker is Dr. Heather Wakely. Dr. Wakely is Associate Professor, Department of Medicine, Division of Oncology, Stanford University, Stanford Cancer Institute. And Dr. Wakely is going to be addressing an overview of lung cancer, current standard of care, and new treatment approaches. It's really my pleasure now to turn the program over to Dr. Wakely.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's great to be on this call. This is really an exciting time in the field of lung cancer because we have had an amazing number of new developments and new treatment options for patients living with this disease. As an overview, lung cancer is a disease that can happen to anyone. It can happen to people of any age, of any ethnic background, from any place in the world, and really with any smoking history. It's because of the smoking association that there's still a lot of stigma associated with lung cancer, but fortunately we've been able to move beyond that. And I really encourage people who either do or do not have a history of smoking who are diagnosed with lung cancer not to let that stigma impact you or your families, but to be able to move beyond that and know that there's nothing you did that led to this disease, that you to move beyond that idea that people somehow have deserved getting lung cancer, which is unfortunately something that people still hear at times. So I just wanted to mention that because that is something a lot of my patients still grapple with, is this idea that when they're telling people that they have lung cancer, that they somehow get asked questions about, well, how did you get it, as opposed to what can I do to help? And so just to let everyone who has have been impacted by this disease sort of hear that, realize you're not alone if you are getting those sorts of questions, and to figure out ways to just ignore that and realize that people who have this illness because of a terrible thing that's happened to them, but in an era now where we have a lot that we're able to do to help folks. So I just wanted to mention that because it is something that does come up. So when people get a diagnosis of lung cancer, there are different stages. Stage 1, 2, we usually are able to treat with surgery or there's some new focused radiation approaches, and Dr. Rosenzweig is going to be focusing on those a little bit. For stage 3, it becomes an approach that's dealing with chemotherapy, radiation, surgery, and then also some of the newer techniques as well. And we're really hoping to be able to cure and are able to cure a lot of patients with stage 1, 2, and 3 disease. With stage 4 disease, and that's where the cancer has spread either beyond the lungs or extensively within the lungs, we have a lot of treatments now to help people live a long and full life, even though they're living with their disease. And, of course, there's a lot of variability in that. I think one of the key things people should know is that you never want to ask the question about, well, how long do I have? Because really nobody knows. And with all of the new treatments we have today, there's really a lot of hope. And I think that's why so many of you have called in today, is to hear about some of these new treatments. Most of the patients I see are living with advanced stage or stage 4 metastatic lung cancer, but really are still able to live and live with that disease. And when someone has a new diagnosis, I talk with them about the three different approaches that we now have to think about the treatment of lung cancer. One of those remains chemotherapy. Chemotherapy has been around for a long time in various different forms. And many of the drugs that we have today that are still very active in lung cancer have been with us for several decades. That doesn't mean that they're bad drugs or that they should be avoided. They actually can play a really important role for many people living with the disease. So I just encourage the listeners not to be afraid of chemotherapy, but to talk about it with their care team and how it may or may not fit into their particular treatment plan. We also now, though, have many different types of options. And as I mentioned, they're really, I think of it in three major categories. There's the chemotherapy. There's the molecular or precision or focus treatments. And Dr. Hellman will be covering that after I'm done speaking today. So I'm not going to talk too much about that. But it is important that if you have a new diagnosis of lung cancer that you've talked to your care team about making sure that testing has been done to look for specific molecular or genetic changes that are specific to your tumor. Because within each lung cancer, we know that there are specific gene changes that have happened. And occasionally, and actually for a large percentage of patients now, there are specific gene changes we can look for, and if we find them, it opens up other treatment options. Many of those are the pill drugs that can have a huge impact for people where their tumor has those specific mutations. And again, Dr. Hellman will go into that in more detail. But the biggest change that's happened really in the last couple of years is with immune-based therapies. And immune therapy has now become a standard approach for a large percentage of patients with lung cancer. And it's really been a tremendous revolution in what we're able to provide our patients living with lung cancer. We now have three drugs that are approved to treat lung cancer that are based on an idea of helping the immune system work better. So these drugs are pembrolizumab, nivolumab, and atezolizumab. And they all work in a similar manner. As most of you are probably aware, the immune system is a very complex system of on signals and off signals, trying to regulate so that our body is able to recognize anything that shouldn't be there, such as a bacteria or virus or cancer cell, but at the same time know what should be there, what's the normal part of us, such as our normal skin, our normal gut. And so it's this difficult balance between getting the immune system to attack anything that shouldn't be there but not attack the rest of us. And that ability to kind of find that fine line between those had made it challenging in the past to develop the best types of immune therapies. But fortunately, these newer classes of drugs, which work by blocking one of the don't attack signals that the cancers use. So there's something called PD-L1, and it interacts with something called PD-1. I don't want to get too technical over the phone, but basically if a tumor is using PD-L1 as a way to say, don't attack, I'm just normal tissue, if you can block that interaction between PD-1 and PD-L1, the immune system is better able to find the cancer cells and attack them. So that's a very simplified version of it. But essentially, these new drugs all interact with that PD-1, PD-L1 connection and block it. And when they do that, the immune system is better able to attack cancer cells, especially cancer cells that are using that PD-L1 mechanism to avoid the immune system. The things that we have to watch carefully for with those drugs are if you get the immune system working too well, you can develop autoimmune processes, which could be a rash or diarrhea or a whole host of other things. But fortunately, those sorts of complications are very rare. And so that's led to the development of these new drugs, which are all now approved for treating lung cancer. All three of them are approved for patients who have previously been treated with chemotherapy. And all of them have been compared to standard chemotherapy in patients who have previously had treatment and shown to improve outcomes for patients in that setting. So this is very exciting that we have this new class of drugs. And just in the last month, one of the drugs, known as pembrolizumab, has been approved as a first-line treatment for patients with lung cancer. And what that means is that for patients who have been newly diagnosed with lung cancer, if their tumor is tested for that PD-L1 protein that I mentioned before, if the level is high, then we now know that for that specific group of patients, and it's probably about a third of all patients with lung cancer, if they have that high PD-L1 expression on their tumor, then using that drug pembrolizumab looks like it's probably better than starting with chemotherapy. So we've known about doing that molecular testing for patients newly diagnosed with advanced stage lung cancer for about a decade for at least one of those gene mutations, and now we know to look for more of them. And just in the last few months, we know it'll start looking for this PD-L1 expression on the tumors as well. And if we either find an appropriate molecular abnormality in the tumor or we find high PD-L1, we can choose either molecular treatment or immune-based therapy instead of chemotherapy to start. And so this has really changed the way we think about lung cancer and the opportunities that we're able to provide our patients for better treatment options. Immune therapy still isn't working for everybody, and that's where there's a lot of research being done. And again, Dr. Hellman's going to be focusing more on the clinical trials. But when one of the things we're really hoping to be able to do is to get immune therapy to work even better so that it works for longer and it works for more patients living with lung cancer, again, still keeping an eye on those potential toxicities. So it's really been a very, very exciting time in the field of lung cancer research and in the field of lung cancer treatment options for patients, that we went from having only chemotherapy to then having chemotherapy plus the molecular targeted treatments, now having molecular therapy in addition to chemotherapy and also having immune-based therapies. So far, we haven't figured out how to combine all of those together, but we do now have a lot of options where we can go sequentially from one treatment to the next, and help people continue to live for a long time and live active and happy lives, even though they're having to face this difficult diagnosis. So with that, I'm going to hand this over to Dr. Hellman and then be able to answer questions.
Oh, thank you so much, Dr. Wakely, for that excellent, really outstanding presentation and really setting the stage for today's program. And our next speaker is Dr. Matthew Hellman. Dr. Hellman is medical oncologist, assistant attending physician, thoracic oncology service division of solid tumor oncology, Department of Medicine, Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center. Dr. Hellman is going to address the role of precision medicine in informing treatment decisions, how clinical trials contribute treatment options, and managing side effects and pain. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Hellman.
Thanks so much, and thank you to all of you participating in this. It's great to have a chance to talk. I think Dr. Wakely gave a fantastic overview of the current landscape in the treatment of patients with lung cancer, and I hope, as you can see, there's been a tremendous progress. There's a lot left to be done, and we're hopeful to work with everyone to get those things done, but I think that there's reason for real hope for people with newly found lung cancer. One of the major advances that Dr. Wakely touched on in understanding the biology of lung cancer and ultimately devising more personalized treatment for people with lung cancer is this idea of a molecularly targeted treatment. Oftentimes when we talk about targeted treatment, it can sometimes be a little confusing to know what does that mean or what are we talking about. People often use words like molecularly targeted or sometimes genetic changes in the tumor, and so it's worth at least talking a little bit about that. Often when people think about genes or genetic alterations, the way in which they most know that is the genes in which you got from your parents or that you would pass on to your children. And so I think one fear that sometimes people have when we talk about testing for particular genes in your cancer is that we're looking for changes that could make your tumor heritable, not just then relevant to you, but potentially to your family. And so it's worth saying that that's not what we're looking for. We're not looking for genes that cause this lung cancer from the time of birth and that may put your family at risk. That is not the case in most lung cancers. What we're looking for are genes or mutations in genes that have developed only in the cancer. These are things that are only found in the cancer, not in the rest of your body, and not in your family members. And so just know that when we're talking about molecularly targeted treatment, we're not talking about a heritable cancer. We're talking about just the cancer cells that are in you. They're not in the rest of the body. But the purpose of doing this sort of testing is to see whether there are specific changes, again, just in the cancer, that can make it uniquely sensitive to specific medicines. It's the idea of sort of pairing a key with a lock. If you get the right key and the right lock and can turn off the cancer, cancers can slow down, cancers can shrink, people can feel better and live longer. And that's been a remarkable achievement over the last decade or so in understanding lung cancers and developing medicines that can be personalized for a specific person. But one of the principles of using targeted medicine is to use them in people that have the specific target. There's no point using the key if you don't have the lock. And the way in which then we find the right person to give the right medicine to is by doing testing and what has been referred to as molecular testing or genetic testing. And what this often entails is using a bit of tumor tissue that's been obtained at the time of a biopsy or a surgery in the past, sometimes even now, using your own blood to see whether there's these specific alterations in the cancer cell. Right now, some tests are able to test not just one or two genes, but sometimes hundreds of genes. And it's important, I think, to talk to your doctor about the specifics of the testing being done. Some of older tests may have only examined one, two, three, or four genes, but I think increasingly it's important that we take a really broad look at all of the genes that may have specific medicines that could work for a given patient. And so it's worth talking to your doctor about the specifics of the test and whether there's any broader approaches that would be useful to make sure that sort of no stone is left unturned. That testing, I think, is also important to note, usually takes a little while. Sometimes it's 1 week, sometimes it's up to a month, if not longer. And so that waiting time can be a struggle, sometimes uncertain of what the information is going to be, and sometimes that makes a difference in terms of whether you start chemotherapy or wait. Aside from acknowledging that sometimes it takes some time, I don't have a faster pathway. But again, I think it's worth sort of talking about with your doctor sort of what's the implications of that wait time, and just knowing that that it's routine for it to take some time and that hopefully that just that bit of knowledge can help reduce anxiety. If the test comes back and finds some alteration in some genes that have a specific target, some of those examples include genes like EGFR or ALK, A-L-K, or ROS1, or BRAF, or HER2. Again, these are just examples of the things that can be found. There often can be specific medicines, often in the form of pills, that can be tried. As a result of clinical trials over the last 8 to 10 years, many of these medicines can be tried outside of a clinical trial. But sometimes the medicines that are available and sometimes the genes that are being tested are new. And that the only way in which to try new medicines, new targeted medicines, is through clinical trials. And so I think it's worth also talking a little bit about what is a clinical trial about, in part because it's been so important to the progress in our treatment of patients with lung cancer, but also because there can sometimes be some misconception. Oftentimes, when people hear the idea of a phase one clinical trial, there can be fears about either the fact that they might be getting a placebo, they might be given a dose that is so low that it can't work, and that the lack of overall knowledge about the potential treatment makes it not worthwhile. And I don't mean to dismiss some of the uncertainties about an early clinical trial, but it's worth hanging in there to have a good conversation with your doctor about what clinical trials are out there, and know that in almost any clinical trial for patients with lung cancer, a placebo is not a treatment option. Almost all clinical trials for patients with lung cancer would include a medicine that has the possibility of helping. And oftentimes, I think more recently, the concept of what is a phase one or phase two clinical trial is changing a little bit. So that even early phase clinical trials may well include medicines that have been studied substantially, that have a known dose, and that have a known possibility of benefit. And so it's worth talking about what is known and what's suspected from trying such a trial. In part because oftentimes for people with specific, even rare, targeted treatment options, a clinical trial offers the best opportunity for treatment. And so I just wanted to touch a little bit on sort of what goes into a clinical trial and make sure that the right questions are asked of your doctor so that you can get comfortable if you were to pursue a clinical trial. You should never pursue a clinical trial that you feel uncomfortable with. But it's worth asking some important questions and not assuming that a given trial is either bad or couldn't help you, because oftentimes it can be the right thing to do. The last thing to touch on is, in the context of clinical trials, is that side effects can occur. It's true. That's true of both clinical trial medicines. It's true of approved medicines. It's true of chemotherapy, and it's true of targeted medicines. And it's hard to predict beforehand how people are going to feel. I suspect that your doctor can give you a good sense of maybe what the top three most common side effects can be. But unfortunately, there can be rare things that occur. And some of the best ways in which we've found to be able to take care of people who have side effects is close communication. Even sometimes when you're not sure of how exactly to describe what you're feeling, just being in touch with your doctor and nurse and care team about what you're feeling, even if it's vague, is worth a lot for them to know what's going on with you and for you to know that they're available. The clinical trial medicines often have more sort of rigorous evaluation of side effects, but it should be true of any medicine that being in close contact with your care team is so critical to being able to try and keep people safe. The other part about side effects is that, especially for targeted therapy medicines, oftentimes the dose can be safely reduced. I think oftentimes people feel like at a lower dose, a given medicine may have a less likelihood of benefit. And that's not always true for targeted medicines. Oftentimes, targeted medicines, the dose can be decreased in order to decrease side effects with no negative impact on benefit. So feel open to the idea of talking with your doctor about whether a given dose should be decreased in order to help you feel better. The purpose of any medicines is to try and help you live longer and live better. And the medicines themselves are making you not live well. It's worth talking about what to do with that and how to make this better so that you can live better and longer. So I hope what I've touched on is a little bit of conceptual, but also sort of some specific advice about how does one go about thinking about treatment options and talking with your doctor. But ultimately, that relationship and that conversation is the most critical part of your care. And if there's other ways in which sort of we can help, please let us know.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Hellman. That was really outstanding and excellent, and appreciate your helping people to really understand many of the new treatments that are out there, the role of physician medicine, and the importance of that communication with the healthcare team is so important. And now our next speaker is Dr. Kenneth Rosenzweig. Dr. Rosenzweig is Assistant Chair, Radiation Oncology, Mount Sinai, Beth Israel, Professor of the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. Dr. Kenneth Rosenzweig is a radiation oncologist, and he'll be addressing the role of radiation oncology, different types of radiation treatments, and communicating with the healthcare team about quality of life concerns. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Dr. Rosenzweig.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for the privilege of being able to speak today. So radiation is used in many different ways in the treatment of lung cancer, and it can be confusing to sort it all out, and even sometimes for the doctors themselves to sort it all out how we use the radiation. So generally I divide the way we give radiation into three different roles. One is for situations where someone's unable to have a surgery. So there are usually two reasons why someone can't have surgery. The first is that the tumor is just not in a good place for it to be cut out safely, or it's a little bit too extensive for the surgeon to safely do the surgery, and in which case radiation takes the place of the surgery. The other situation is where the person's just not in good enough shape to have the surgery. So, someone who might be a little bit older, you know, let's say having kidney problems or lung problems or heart problems, and just a lung surgery, since it's a very aggressive surgery, just might be a little bit too difficult for them to get through. So also in these situations, the radiation takes the place of the surgery. So this is for all stages of cancer, of lung cancer. So for early stage lung cancer, those situations, almost by definition, the tumor's going to be able to be safely cut out. But if the person's not in good shape to have the surgery, then we give radiation. And also for advanced lung cancer, where the nodes might be involved, where it's a bigger tumor that might be invading nearby structures, if the surgery's not an option, then we use the radiation. So that's one role of radiation in place of surgery. The other role, and this is probably the least commonly used way to give radiation, is after a surgery to help kill any cells that might be left behind. So kind of the classic example is someone has had a surgery for a tumor that has involved the nodes. The surgeon removes all the nodes from the center of the chest, but there are some concerns that there might be some cancer cells left behind, and we give some radiation to the center of the chest to kill any cancer cells that might be there. Again, this is an uncommonly used scenario. It's very individualized decision whether or not that person needs the radiation. So that's not a gimme after a surgery. And in fact, most times after surgery, you will not need radiation. And then the third role of radiation is to help people who are having difficulties from the tumor that might be causing symptoms. So whether it's a tumor in the lung that's pressing on a breathing tube and causing some shortness of breath, whether it's spread outside of the lung to the brain, to some of the bones where it might be causing pains or other symptoms, radiation is an excellent treatment to alleviate those symptoms, what we call palliative radiation. So radiation comes in many different forms. The vast, vast majority of treatments for lung cancer are done with what we call a linear accelerator. So that's a machine. It's a big, expensive machine that's usually in the basement of a hospital or a medical center that patient comes in, lies down, and the machine rotates around them, delivering the radiation. The patient gets up and goes home afterwards. And like I said, the vast majority of treatments are done with a linear accelerator. Pretty much every city has multiple radiation therapy centers in their city. I'm in New York City right now, and I sometimes joke we have one on every corner next to the Chinese restaurants and the dry cleaners. And that's not accurate, but sometimes it really seems that way. But certainly wherever you are, there's almost certainly a place to get radiation within a few miles. There are different ways to deliver the radiation, and it's really depends on the sophistication of the physics used to deliver the radiation. So the classic way we delivered radiation is just from the front and from the back, what we would call two-dimensional radiation. And we still use this quite frequently. This is most typically used now for palliative situations where you don't need advanced physics techniques that are going to delay the start of the treatment, and you just want to get the treatment going, and it's going to be an effective treatment for the area that you're aiming the radiation beam at. So much how Dr. Wakely talked about, you know, standard chemotherapy, this is also still used, two-dimensional radiation. But for anything that's more advanced, where we're trying to deliver a higher dose of radiation, where we're trying to be more aggressive and kill the cancer for a long-term control and not just a palliative situation, we're almost always going to use more advanced physics techniques with three-dimensional radiation therapy, or IMRT, which stands for intensity modulated radiation therapy, which is a complicated physics term, but it describes how it's given. So the 3D or advanced radiation is we get a CT scan of the person before the treatment. We figure out where the tumor is. We figure out which normal tissues we need to avoid, such as the lung is an obvious one, or the heart. And just with the advent of fast computer power, we're able to direct the beams from the right angles. So like I said, with 2D radiation, in the old days, we just go from the front and from the back, and it might be that a lot of the heart was getting treated that way. Now with 3D and IMRT, we're able to know, well, maybe coming in at a 30-degree angle is going to be beneficial for this particular person. And IMRT is a more complicated way of doing 3D radiation, and that's really very useful when you have a tumor that's right next to a very important organ, such as the heart or the spinal cord or other key structures like that. And there's another form of radiation therapy that you've probably heard of just because it's on the news a lot and commercials, and this is called stereotactic body radiation therapy, SBRT. Some people call it stereotactic ablative body radiation, SABR, or SABR. They're both the same thing. I think the people who came up with the word SABR were Star Wars fans, so they wanted a term that sounded cool to them. So this technique is an advanced form of IMRT, but it also involves taking pictures of the person before we do the radiation to make sure that we're on target. So even with 3D and IMRT, we usually put about a centimeter of margin around where we want to aim the beam to make sure that we're hitting all the tumor. And because we know that people might shift or squirm during the radiation, or because of the breathing, the tumor might move or the heart beating. With SBRT, we put the patient a very specialized cast to make sure that they limit their motion, and we take extensive imaging before we do the treatment so that we can really have a high degree of accuracy of where we're aiming the beam to within 2 millimeters. And that allows us to deliver a much higher dose of radiation and limit the number of treatments. So back when I first started doing radiation therapy, we would, for an early stage lung cancer, we would typically do 30 treatments or 35 treatments. Now for an early stage lung cancer, because we use SBRT for it, we can do all the treatment in 3 or 4 treatments. So it's really been an enormous convenience for patients who are coming in, and also it's extremely effective with cure rates that are approaching close to surgery. So it's really been a very exciting time in radiation oncology, because it used to be if you couldn't have surgery for your early stage lung cancer, it was a big step down to getting radiation therapy. Now they're almost equivalent. I still recommend surgery for all my patients who are able to tolerate surgery for their early stage disease. But if you're unable to have the surgery, it's not a big drop-off to get the radiation instead. Right now, SBRT, the very focused high-dose treatments, is only applicable to people with early-stage lung cancer, so that's a small tumor without the nodes involved. And there's some research trying to apply it to more advanced disease. It's also used a lot for some palliative treatments, like for treatments to the brain or some other organs where you're trying to get a high dose and you're trying to get a high degree of accuracy. And finally, the last technology I want to talk about is proton radiation. So proton radiation is a very, very advanced form of radiation. It's a different machine than a linear accelerator. It's a massive machine that takes up almost an entire city block for the cyclotron. And it's a very expensive form of technology. So typically, a city might only have one in the entire city, and often many cities don't have a proton machine. So, for example, New York City currently doesn't have one, though there's currently one under construction by a number of medical centers working together. But there's some of the earliest proton facilities were in Boston, California, and there are also some very very well-known facilities in Philadelphia and Houston as well. And the advantage of protons is it can deliver radiation really up to a specific point, and then the radiation dose drops off immediately after that. So unlike typical radiation, where the radiation might be going all throughout the body, this really limits the dose. So proton radiation is ideal for children because you don't want someone who is potentially going to live another 50, 60, 70 years to have been have their whole body exposed to radiation. It's not well known how effective proton radiation is in the lung. Right now, it doesn't seem to be that helpful, except for maybe situations where the tumors come back. It's still under investigation by a number of places, but if your physician has not talked to you about proton radiation, they're not holding something back because it's still an investigative technique in lung cancer and something we're still learning about, but not necessarily something that every patient walking through the door should be getting. So I think I'm out of time there, but then I certainly will be available for questions during the remainder of the call.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Rosenzweig, for just a very thorough and comprehensive presentation on the role of radiation in oncology. I really appreciate that. I think our audience, our participants do, and I'm sure we'll have questions for you during the Q&A. Thank you. And our next speaker is Diana Bearden, and Ms. Bearden is a dietitian, an oncology dietitian. She supervised at Clinical Nutrition, the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, and Ms. Bearden is going to address nutritional concerns and tips. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Ms. Bearden.
Thank you, Carolyn. It's a pleasure to be part of today's education opportunity. Most treatments for cancer result in side effects that can impact your tolerance to diet. These side effects may be temporary or have lasting effects. Treatments can increase your need for nutrition and may require diet modifications. Eating well during treatment can impact your tolerance to treatment, improve your rate of recovery, reduce treatment delays, and assist with reducing fatigue. A dietitian can assist you by providing you ideas for meeting your individual nutritional goals. To give you an overview, things that you may hear during your treatment related to diet are things like calories. Calories provide the energy for us to do the things we want to do. It helps maintain weight, gain weight. With less of them, we lose weight. It can also work towards promoting to heal during and after treatments. Calories come from three major things: carbohydrates, fat, and protein. So carbohydrates, fat, and protein may be changed or altered or modified in some way to meet your individual needs based on other comorbidities or health concerns you might have. So meeting with a dietitian can help you individualize the diet restrictions or unique features about your diet that would work best for you. oftentimes a decrease in appetite can occur during treatment. And this can be related to a number of things. It can be related to the disease itself. It can be related to side effects from the treatment, medications, and the side effects from those medications. And so oftentimes encouraging folks to increase their calorie intake may result in hearing things like, you know, try having small, frequent meals throughout the day, eating higher calorie, higher protein foods. And what this can do for patients is reduce the feeling of being overwhelmed, getting in the calories that you need each day without the volume. You can also fortify food, so add something to your food. There's a lot of different things that are in our food supply that we can just add to what we're already eating. There's also some modulars, things that are pharmaceutically derived that might be an option for you. And so meeting with your dietitian, she can help answer those questions and give you some guidance. But to break it down a little bit more, as we look at carbohydrates, that's our main energy source. Those are things like breads and pastas and fruits, and there's a little bit in our veggies, not a lot. And then protein. Protein's very important. Protein helps protect your lean muscle mass. It really aids in helping you heal. Protein you eat can be used for energy, and that would then in turn preserve your store so you wouldn't see as much of a weight change. It's best to include protein at each meal. So you want to have protein, carbohydrates, and fat at each meal. So just remembering something from each group. Sources of protein include things like eggs, dairy products, meats. There are even some protein supplements over the counter, things you can use to fortify your food with. So there are a lot of opportunities to get protein in your diet. Fat often comes along with our protein. It's things that we add to our food oftentimes. So it might be butter, it might be cream, things like that. But oftentimes it's mixed within our food. So we can get that without having to add an extra item. Adequate fluid is very important to remember. Hydration is something oftentimes we overlook. We're worried about weight. We're looking at calories and protein and all that good stuff. But when you're not eating as much, oftentimes you don't drink as much. And hydration is very important. Dehydration can actually make you feel worse. It can give several side effects, headaches, nausea, dizziness, constipation, make you feel more tired, fatigued. So fluid is anything that's liquid at room temperature. Water, juice, sports drink, soups, Jell-O, ice cream, all of those sorts of things turn liquid at room temperature. And so if you're trying to, you know, kind of get two birds with one stone, oftentimes you can fortify what you're drinking and get additional calories and protein. So there's a lot of ways a dietitian can help make meeting your goals easier. Oftentimes, medications and side effects can result, or side effects from medications can result in uncomfortable side effects for patients, things like diarrhea, nausea, vomiting. And so there might be a need for you to take medication just to help with these side effects. I have patients oftentimes that don't really want to take any more medication, but listen to your healthcare team. The drugs that they're giving you have been studied. They know when side effects will oftentimes approach, and you'll have these different experiences. And so taking the medication as prescribed is essential. Even if you don't feel it and you don't think you need it, take it anyway. The team really knows what is about to come, and they want to help alleviate as much as they can you experiencing uncomfortable side effects. If you are having difficulty with weight, keeping a daily food record can be very helpful. It will also make you aware of actually how much you're eating. Oftentimes our memory doesn't serve us very well, and so writing that down can be useful for your team and for yourself. So you know, just being mindful of what you're taking in each day is a good way for you to know, okay, I really didn't eat as much as I normally do. And a new normal might be somewhere in your future with treatment. And so just being mindful of actually what you're consuming is a great way to just have that awareness. Diet modifications might be necessary during or even after treatment. Swallowing might be a challenge for you. Maybe you have a pain in your burning in your chest or your digestion. Maybe you're having more issues with reflux. So there might be different things along the way that the diet may have to change to help you with those side effects. After cancer treatment, the nutrition is also continuing to be important. You're going through a healing process, so don't give up even after your treatment to being aware of what you're eating and how you're eating. A dietitian will be very helpful in reducing or giving you information on how to reduce risk of disease of reoccurrence or of a new disease process. There are guidelines out there related to nutrition, and they can help modify them to meet your specific needs. But remember, our main goal is to get the nutrition in that you need, maintaining your weight, maintaining lean muscle mass during your treatment course. Please communicate with your healthcare team. They don't know unless you tell them. And we want to help you be as successful as you can with getting through your treatment and as painless as possible as well. That wraps it up for me. I'm going to hand this back over to Carolyn. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much, Diana. That was really excellent and really lots of good tips for people. And our last speaker is Mr. Andrew Chesler. And Mr. Chesler is an oncology social worker. He's with Cancer Care. And Mr. Chesler is going to address Cancer Care's free psychosocial programs and services and the role of support groups. It's my pleasure now to turn this program over to Mr. Chesler.
Thank you, Carol. It's a pleasure to be part of the call today. I'd like to start just by speaking about the importance of creating a support network when you're diagnosed with lung cancer and how we at Cancer Care might be a part of that network. There are several ways we might be able to help. Just a brief overview. Cancer Care is a national nonprofit organization that provides free professional support services to anyone affected by cancer, not just lung cancer patients. Cancer care programs include individual counseling, support groups, education about resources, and how to navigate the healthcare system, practical help, and some limited financial assistance. All of our services are delivered by master's level oncology social workers and are completely free of charge. Oncology social workers, like myself, are trained in how a diagnosis of cancer affects a person and his or her family and friends. And we're experienced in helping people to manage the emotional and the physical and financial challenges that arise after a diagnosis. Adjusting to and dealing with the diagnosis is an important part of the healing process. I'd like to emphasize that asking for help by joining a support group or contacting a social worker for counseling is a sign of strength. Cancer Care offers face-to-face groups in our local offices, which are in the New York City area, as well as telephone and online groups nationally. So we really serve the entire country. These groups offer a unique opportunity to connect with people affected by lung cancer, along with the help of a Cancer Care social worker to facilitate the group. Sharing information and understanding with others in similar situations can be a very powerful experience. Group members offer encouragement, a sense of community, and conversation that can provide a cancer patient with additional support and guidance. And these connections really help lessen the isolation that many people with cancer experience. As we've learned from today's other speakers, there's a lot of information to digest and to make sense of. A social worker, our social workers at Cancer Care and others in your hospitals can help you understand what this all means for you as a patient and your family and caregivers. A Cancer Care social worker can help you prioritize and consider questions that you might want to ask to get the information that you need, because there's a lot of information coming at you. Please remember that you're not alone. Our services at Cancer Care are here to help you. You can contact us at 1-800-813-HOPE. That's 800-813-4673. Or log on to our website at www.cancercare.org for more information about our oncology support, social work support. Thank you for your attention and the opportunity to talk to you today.
Oh, thank you so much, Ms. Chesler, an outstanding presentation. And now we have time for questions. We actually have a lot of time for questions. I'm going to ask Stephanie to bring all of our speakers on board and to also explain to all of you how to queue up for questions. And I just want to remind everyone, if you don't have a chance to ask your question today, at the end of the call today, I'll give you direction of how to get your questions answered, because I know that's most important to all of you. Stephanie?
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. If you would like to ask a question, please press star then one on your touchtone telephone. If your question has been answered and you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. Those of you on the web may submit questions by clicking ask a question. As a reminder, please press star then one to ask a question.
So a question from one of our online participants from Bruce, and I'm going to direct this question to Dr. Wakely. So the question is, what medical symptoms would alert a physician to the possibility of a patient being diagnosed with lung cancer? Dr. Wakely, can you answer that in a general way?
So that's a great question and a really tough question, because lung cancer can present in many, many, many different ways. One of the other really big developments in lung cancer that has come out in the last few years is for screening. But the screening that exists today is still somewhat limited. It's only for patients in a specific age range, at least 50 years old, with a pretty heavy smoking history, who have only quit smoking within the last 10 to 15 years. And obviously that does not include all people with lung cancer. As I mentioned earlier, anybody can get lung cancer, young people who have no smoking history, though of course it's more common in people with a heavy smoking history and as people get older. So the screening that we do have is important, because it can find some lung cancers at a much earlier stage when we're more likely to be able to cure them. But for other folks, and for most of the patients I have with lung cancer, there's really no one specific symptom, because the symptoms of lung cancer can be absolutely nothing until it's quite widespread and is found because someone's getting an X-ray for something else. Or it can present with coughing up blood, or it can present with just a cough, or it can present with pain if it's spread to particular area. And I don't want to scare everyone by saying, oh, it can happen at any time to anybody. It is still, like all cancers, not that common. But it doesn't follow a pattern where it's something that someone usually has missed because they didn't think about it. It's just so many other things can behave the same way. It just is difficult to diagnose until we have better screening. And the screening that's being developed now, currently it's just with scans, CT scans, but people are working on blood tests where we will be able to identify not just lung cancer, but a lot of other cancers much earlier in the future. We're just not at that point right now.
Thank you so much. My question, actually, for Diana, to what degree are homeopathic organic diets recommended? Are specific foods not recommended for lung cancer patients? So, Diana, if you could just address that in a general way, the spirit in terms of just specific foods not recommended for people with lung cancer.
Yeah, that's a great question. I get asked about organic quite often. And we don't advocate organic necessarily. What we want is really for folks just to eat a balanced diet, one that's appropriate for their needs. Cleaning your plant-based foods is important, whether they're organic or conventionally grown. And so we encourage folks to be sure to wash and clean their fruits and vegetables. Frozen is another option, where the exposure to the pesticides and other chemicals that people are very concerned about is less, because it doesn't have the same transportation method, and it's just harvested and processed differently. And so the answer to that question, I guess, is that we do not make recommendations for organic products. We really just encourage a balanced diet, and one that is appropriate for meeting a patient's health needs.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I do have a question. Thank you. We have a question in queue. Stephanie?
Our question comes from Audrey T. Your line is open.
Yes, I was wondering with small cell lung cancer, if head radiation is an option prophylactically.
Yeah, so that's an excellent question. So I think all the speakers today were talking mostly about non-small cell lung cancer. Small cell lung cancer has a lot in common with non-small cell lung cancer, but there are still some key differences. So we know with both forms of lung cancer that, unfortunately, a common site of the tumor coming back is in the brain. So for both diseases, we've tried the situation after people have finished their initial treatment, typically with chemotherapy and radiation. We then give radiation to the brain because the feeling is that there might be some microscopic cancer cells in the brain that no MRI, no CT scan, no PET scan is ever going to find. They're just too small. But there's a concern that chemotherapy can't penetrate into the brain. There's something called the blood-brain barrier, which just prevents some chemicals getting into the brain. And unfortunately, most chemotherapies just can't get in there to kill the cancer cells. Radiation, since it's not a chemical, isn't affected by that. So for both diseases, non-small cell and small cell, we've tried giving radiation to the brain. In small cell, it has improved survival. So it is something that we typically recommend for people with small cell lung cancer where the tumor hasn't spread to any other part of the body, and we give it after all the other treatments done. So after the chemotherapy, the radiation, some more chemo, if people are in good shape and doing well, we typically do recommend the radiation. It does have some side effects. It makes people very tired. It can cause hair loss again, or pretty much always causes hair loss again. So it's a little bit frustrating. You've gone through the chemo, your hair's growing back, and then it falls out again. It does grow back afterwards, but it is very annoying. And one thing we've been working on is that radiation to the brain can cause some short-term memory problems. So like your ability to memorize a shopping list can be a little bit worse after the radiation. So we're trying some new techniques with what I was discussing before, IMRT, to spare the portions of the brain that might cause memory loss, and that seems to be working well. So that's what I offer to all my patients at this point. So the short answer is yes. Unfortunately, for the main type of lung cancer, non-small cell, giving radiation to the brain didn't help people live longer, so we typically do not recommend that.
Thank you. That's a really excellent question, and thank you, Dr. Rosenzweig, for addressing it and so comprehensively. I have one last late-breaking question before we conclude today from one of our online participants. I have read there's a higher risk for Asian women in lung cancer. Is this true? Dr. Wakely, could you address this question?
So we know that of the patients who get lung cancer who do not have any sort of history of smoking, it does tend to be more in women than in men, meaning that if you look at all the people who have lung cancer who are women, more of them have never smoked than if you look at all the men who have lung cancer. And if you look at different ethnicities in Asia, if you look in the Asian countries, not just Asian Americans, the percentage of women who have lung cancer who have never smoked is quite high. It's like over 50% of the women who get lung cancer in many Asian countries have never smoked, as opposed to in the United States it's about 20%. So it's not that there's necessarily higher rates. It's just that the reasons people get lung cancer are different, and we have, and many, many people have done a lot of work trying to figure out why this is happening, but we still don't have any clear answers about it. And so my practice is in Northern California, and so a high percentage of my patients are Asian, either born in Asia or Asian Americans. It's a very complicated question. I wouldn't look at it as Asian women are at higher risk, just that if you look at people getting lung cancer who have never smoked, a higher percentage of them are Asian women.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Is there anything that those women should do in terms of their health care access or working with their primary care physician or their pulmonary team or anything like that that you could suggest, Dr. Wakely?
And that really gets back to the screening question that we had touched on earlier. Other than a very select group of folks, where we now have a trial result showing that doing annual CT scans can find lung cancers earlier, we don't know how to apply that to the majority of the population in the United States and around the world. So for people who aren't fitting in that the lung cancer screening category, we don't really know how to screen yet. And I know that, again, it's always frightening to sort of feel like there's a risk out there and there's no way to look for it. There is a lot of work being done trying to figure out who is at higher risk and how do we find lung cancer earlier in people where it is developing. There's a lot of research being done, but we still don't have any straightforward answers for that.
Well, thank you. And I want to thank all of our speakers. You've been phenomenal. I want to thank all of our participants who've asked great questions on the telephone or online, and all of you who've been listening. Now, I did say that at the end of the program today, I would let you know that if you still have questions, which I know some of you do, and may develop questions, that I want you to know where to get your questions answered. So first of all, if you have further medical questions about lung cancer, I definitely recommend that you call the National Cancer Institute at 1-800-422-6237. That's 1-800-422-6237. And those numbers will be sent out to all of you as well. And if indeed you have a desire to speak with one of our cancer care social workers around either practical or financial assistance or counseling services or joining a support group or any practical information we might be able to provide or joining one of these workshops that we offer, or getting a publication, I would definitely suggest that you call Cancer Care. And you can call us at 1-800-813-4673. And for international participants, please come to our website at www.cancercare.org. We'll very much be able to be helpful to you. Most importantly, as we conclude our program today, I don't want anyone to think that you're alone in coping with lung cancer or any type of cancer. I want you to now know that you are part of the cancer care community and that you can contact us at any time with any question. We will be sure to help you with that. In addition, I do want to let you know there's a part two to this program. And so I know there are many caregivers on the program, and part two focuses on caregivers, practical tips for coping with your loved one's lung cancer. And it is open both to caregivers and to people living with lung cancer as well. So we welcome you to that program on November 15th. At the same time, 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Again, I want to thank you all for your participation today, and I want to wish you all a very fine day. Thank you all.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your participation. This concludes the workshop. You may now disconnect and have a wonderful day.